Well, hello everybody. It's the start. It's 2 o'clock here on the East Coast, which means mountain time. It's noon, which means it is 12:12:12, the date, and the time is 12. And at some point, after about 12 minutes, it will be 12:12:12, and it will be 12:12. So that's momentous. It's a nice way to start out. Hope everybody's doing well today. And before we start, what I'd like to ask, Chelsea is here and many of you are here and I expect some will join. But what I'd like to start out with is just a brief meditation, maybe about 30 seconds or so, where we can all just leave our baggage at the door, shed whatever we don't need, and just really get present with each other and introduce in to your consciousness and our consciousness, our awareness, gratitude, or introduce in the divine, however we see the divine, and just take a moment to invite that divine in to this circle that we're sharing. Everybody's on mute for right now, except for Chelsea and I, and we'll start chatting in a minute. And occasionally I might just let newcomers know that we're having a little silent meditation for a minute or so. So let's just do that. Let's just get present and accounted for. Anybody who's just joined us, we're just having a minute of quiet meditation before we start, just to get present. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. And so before I introduce Chelsea, what I'd like to do is just introduce myself and why we're here today. My name is Dr. Claudia Welch, and you probably found me through my website or something. My website is www.drclaudiawelch, like the grape juice, no S, .com. And I'm fortunate enough to have a number of mentorship groups where these beautiful students and practitioners get together and we talk about case studies and we talk about issues that are coming up with our patients and our clients. And many of these are Ayurvedic practitioners, but we also have some yoga teachers and some people who are both. And every once in a while, a really important topic comes up where I like to bring in someone from the outside to help us address it and explore it a little bit. We've done that with mass cleanse issues before, and you can find those recordings on the website. And so recently, one of the students, actually a couple of the students, came up with a question about eating disorders and saying, hey, I don't hear much about this in Ayurveda or yoga. How do we address eating disorders? And there's lots of different kinds of eating disorders, but we're going to probably mostly look at anorexia today, anorexia nervosa, and a little bit with bulimia, and not so much about overeating today. And one of the questions comes up about what is our responsibility as practitioners when we see somebody, when someone comes in and is very, very thin. What do we do with this? And I have some thoughts. I haven't worked with this a lot. I am not an expert on eating disorders. And so I wanted to bring in Chelsea, who I'll introduce in a moment. And I also had some wonderful conversations over the last week with several people who came forward and said, "Hey, I know about this stuff," and so we would talk about it. So I just want to thank them. I want to thank Dr. Beth Janaris, and she, if you want to know about her, she's in Albuquerque. She's at www.bethgeneris.com. That's Beth, G-I-N-E-R-I-S. And a few other people who wanted to remain anonymous because they work with people with eating disorders and wanted to keep that relationship more private. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Kathleen Demaison, who's a PhD at RadiantRecovery.com, and because both of them took the time to either speak with me or write to me about their thoughts on it. And this really seemed to strike a chord with people. A number of you wrote in and said that this was important to you. And so I do have some thoughts, and the people I spoke with confirmed that they felt that it was kind of the right direction. So I'd love to share that with you. But this, we have such a wonderful opportunity to talk with Chelsea Roff today, and let me introduce you by reading her biography. You can read more about her and her speaking topics, which include a lot about eating disorders, but many other things. Chelsea, her website is www.chelsearoff.com, so ChelseaRoff.com, and I'm going to read you her bio here because she says it better than I can. Chelsea Roff is a nationally recognized author, speaker, and yoga instructor. She serves as managing editor for the Chopra family's online magazine, Intent, and integrates her background in science, women's health, and humanitarian issues in her teaching and writing. Her work has been featured on the front page of AOL.com, and she writes regularly for Huffington Post, Yahoo Shine, Care 2, and Yoga Journal. Prior to entering the world of journalism, Chelsea worked as a researcher in a psychoneuroimmunology laboratory. As a student of neuroscience, she came to appreciate how stress affects mental, emotional, and social health, and how mind-body practices like yoga can improve the outcome of chronic illness like HIV, AIDS, and cancer. So, also, if you haven't read her article, Starving for Connection, it is a beautiful account, honest, vulnerable, vibrant, eloquent, beautiful account of her own history with anorexia nervosa and eating disorder. And she speaks about her own history with this in really honest, vulnerable, beautiful terms. And it's very inspiring because she is out on the other end and attributes a lot of her healing to yoga, and she speaks to the practitioners and patients at the facility that helped her recover. And this is something, correct me if I'm wrong, Chelsea, but it seems like it's really dear to your heart, and I'm really glad to have you here. And is there anything you'd like to say otherwise by way of introduction?
No, I think you captured it pretty well, and it's absolutely very dear to my heart.
All right. So, and if everybody is not aware, Chelsea is not only so dedicated to this, she's also very young. She's young and beautiful and vibrant, and I think she's going to offer so much to this talk because of her extensive experience. So to kind of get us, she could talk on many different things, but to kind of get us going, Chelsea, I think I want to just let's start here. One of the things I've worked at rape crisis centers, and you get, of course, if you study anything about rape, that there's ignorant questions that we ask because we don't know any better. We say, well, what did you do to bring this on, right? Mm-hmm. And that's born out of ignorance. And in domestic violence, if you take a domestic violence training, you learn that one ignorant question that's really easy to ask is, well, why don't you leave him? And there's about a bazillion good reasons why someone wouldn't leave a domestic violence situation. And so you learn what the ignorant questions are and what you really need to know as practitioners. You get a small training, and I know that we've only got about an hour to talk, and then maybe 20 minutes to do question and answer. So we won't get a huge education about this, but as Ayurvedic practitioners and as yoga instructors, what I'd love to hear from your perspective is, what are the ignorant questions and what are the things we really have to know? And I know we don't have time probably for all of that, but let's get started with the basics.
Well, we should say before, I have no idea what questions he's going to ask me. So these are totally spur of the moment answers. But as soon as you started listing some of those common ignorant questions that you get in those other scenarios, the first question that comes to mind is, why don't they just eat? I cannot tell you how often I hear that. You know, well, why don't they just eat a hamburger? Why don't they just go and do that? And I think that probably because the stereotypes about eating disorders are just so prevalent, and there's one of the ones that probably is most common is that women with eating disorders are shallow and just want to be thin, or that they just want to be thin. Maybe the shallow isn't even laced on that. And so the belief is that recovery should be pretty simple. It should just be refeeding, and it's that simple. And I think that oftentimes practitioners or clinicians and holistic health practitioners may not recognize the complexity and the psychological complexity and even the biological complexity of the illness. And it really is an illness. It really is a disease. We now know that there's genetic markers that can be traced to, you know, how anorexia or any eating disorder is passed down through families. And there's all sorts of very, very weird things that happen to the brain during starvation. And because of that, it's not as simple as just eating or just giving someone a meal plan or just saying, you know, well, if you'll eat this, this, and this, you'll gain the weight you need to, and your mind will be functioning normally again. There's a whole lot of other things that need to be addressed. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's really helpful. And one thing that I might mention to people is this is a disorder. It's not really talked about as far as I know in the classics in Ayurvedic medicine. It's not. In 4 years of Chinese medicine school, I never heard it talked about once. In Ayurvedic education, I didn't hear it talked about. And we understand, you know, we sort of want to think of it as a vata disorder in Ayurvedic terminology, and it is. But it is severe. It's severe, and it's life-threatening. And it's something that probably, and I would say definitely, if you haven't worked with it, and even if you have to a small extent, it's a really good idea to have to refer out to someone who has and someone who knows how to deal with it, because we want to stay within our area of knowledge. Now, we can support the process, and I'm going to talk about ways we can do that and ways we can understand it and support it that may be different or complementary, let's say, to a treatment program, but I think it's important for people in the same way that if an addict were to show up, someone who was an alcoholic or addicted to drugs, that we would want to get support in place, trained support. And would you agree with that, Chelsea?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree, and I think that goes for both Ayurvedic practitioners and yoga instructors and people who teach Tai Chi, anyone that provides these other modalities of healing. I think they can be so incredibly valuable to recovery, and I think they're undervalued by traditional medicine, and so I think that there's such a rich opportunity for dialogue there. What I would say, though, is that I don't think that it's going to be easy. I don't think that, or maybe I can say that a different way. I don't think that it's that offering yoga or Ayurveda as a complementary modality will necessarily be simple, because oftentimes the treatment programs that sufferers are prescribed by their doctors are directly in conflict with what an Ayurvedic practitioner might suggest.
Can you give an example of something like that, Chelsea?
I sure can. So when I was in inpatient treatment, just to give you a sense of how severe I was and how severe people, how bad it often is when people get to the point that they're in inpatient treatment. I mean, severely underweight. I was 58 pounds when I was taken into the hospital. I don't think most people ever get that low, but they're definitely underweight. And so the first thing doctors have to worry about is refeeding syndrome. And so usually when people are vastly underweight, they're given an NG tube. And it's just straight up ensure through an NG tube for however long it takes to kind of get them to a stable point. And then they're given a meal plan. And usually, for anyone in the hospital, whether they're underweight, whether they're a little bit overweight, the meal plan is very highly structured. And you get three meals a day and three snacks in between. The first meal is usually at 7 or 8 a.m., and almost every treatment center I go to, I'm not kind of counting some of the more alternative treatment centers that are starting to emerge, but most traditional treatment centers will give you 30 minutes for a meal. You have a certain number of calories or a certain number of exchanges, like carbs, proteins, fat grams, that have to be on your plate. And if you don't finish that meal within 30 minutes, usually you're given an NG tube to make up for the calories that you're deficient in.
Can you let people know what an NG tube is?
A nasogastric tube, I think. It's basically a medical tube that's inserted through the nostril and goes down to the throat, and it's how doctors give people liquid nourishment. So oftentimes that's the anorexic or anyone with an eating disorder's greatest fear. I have horrible traumatic memories of having NG tubes placed with me basically kicking and screaming. They're very, very scary because it basically symbolizes you losing control over what goes into your body, which for me was my greatest fear. But to kind of give you a little bit more of a sense, those meals, I remember being in the hospital, and at mealtime, one of the rules was you're not allowed to talk about food at the meal. So there would be games we would play during meals to distract us from what we were eating. So we would play, this game where you would go around the table and name different movie stars. We got 30 minutes, and oftentimes what was on my plate was hospital food. So it was like Jell-O, yogurt, cottage cheese mixed into the yogurt, a garden burger, a slice of cheese, three buns, like whatever it needed to be to make the number of calories that I had to be. And they didn't work together at all, and I didn't have any choice usually until I was at a higher level of treatment what was on my plate. So the reason I say this, it's a really, really complex thing for Ayurvedic practitioners to at least be involved at that level of treatment, is that I think that the doctors and nurses and staff at that point are just so concerned with saving the person's life that they're not interested in teaching them how to listen to their hunger fullness signals. They're not interested in teaching them how to eat in accordance with their dosha. They're not interested in any of those things. All they want to do is pump the calories in so that this person can regain the weight they need.
Right. Right. So I want to talk about this a little bit. I have so many other things to bring up for you, Chelsea, and places I'd like you to share with us. But one of the things I want to mention here that when I was talking with Beth Janaris, she said, look, when people come to you who have had eating disorders, they know way more about nutrition and food and timing than you will ever know for their case. So don't try to compete with them around that. And I loved her saying that because I have really limited experience working with eating disorders in my practice. But when I did work with it, here's what I found is in terms of my role is sometimes, okay, forget about my role seemed to, two things seem to be most important to me in this case is, and as a student of neuroscience, Chelsea, I think you'll appreciate this. Our brains don't have the ability to change patterns. They have the ability to replace them. So if we're thinking about food, then all the time, and controlling our bodies and what's happening in terms of food, and food is a method to control the body, and food, and then we're being treated with food, you have to eat this food this time. All of that stuff is really important, but it's all this focus on food, which the Sanskrit word for food is anna. And the annamaya kosha is the physical body, literally made of anna, right? This sheet that's made of food. So there's a tremendous amount of focus on food and identification with food, because when we look in Ayurvedic and Indian philosophy, sort of mix of Tantra and India, Ayurveda kind of mushed together pudding, like the cottage cheese and the yogurt, right? When we put these a couple of ideas from Tantra and Ayurveda together, what we see is that prana, our life force, follows our focus, and our identity, who we believe we are, follows the prana and the focus. So what we focus on, we begin to identify with. So there's a tremendous identification with the food body, with the annamaya kosha in eating disorders. And so one of the things we can do, I think, and this is a conversation, Chelsea, because I've seen it work with as a good support in my experience, but I'd love to hear how this resonates with you, is to help remind the person that they're not just the food body, that there's the pranamaya kosha that extends beyond the food body, that is the life force body. And this body is shifting with each thought and each impression. So in terms of what I was talking about, the brain, in terms of not being able to break patterns, but only being able to replace them, if we're focusing on food one way, and then an Ayurvedic practitioner comes along and says, oh, well, eat your food this way instead, it's still focus on food. It still lights up those pathways in the brain and reinforces food pathways. Whereas if we say, okay, let somebody else deal with the food issues here, how about you and me sit down and focus on something besides food, right?
Oh, yes.
Focus on the pranamaya kosha. Start developing a relationship with the pranamaya kosha. So what is the issue with food? One of the things is, okay, you said, which I hear repeated with people who have worked with eating disorders a lot, is there's this need to control the body. There's been so much out of control in the person's life here's a domain that they can control, and they can control it with food. But if we I kind of lost my train of thought, so maybe I'll go back there. But if we stop thinking about controlling the body with food, and we start thinking about where we're putting our attention, and shift where we're putting our attention, replace the pattern. Not thinking about food, but remembering what it's like to be whole. Because in the worst case scenario, when the annamaya kosha is really traumatized, the pranamaya kosha can at least momentarily find wholeness. And the person can remember what it's like to feel wholeness and start focusing on that. So I lost one of the trains of thought that I was going on. But does that make sense, Chelsea?
Yeah, a lot of it does, especially what you were initially talking about Ayurvedic practitioners maybe saying, okay, while you are in this high level of care, I'm going to let someone else deal with the food, and I'm going to work with you to relate to your body as something other than that annamaya kosha. That makes a lot of sense to me, and it makes me think about why yoga was such a potent remedy for me, you know, especially as I was stepping out of inpatient treatment and into outpatient treatment. I think that as an alternative, form of medicine really for me, it was incredibly useful. And part of the reason it was so useful is it gave me a different way of relating to my body. And it built those replacement patterns you're talking about in the brain, because I was physically bringing this alternate way of being in my body into being through yoga, through a physical practice. And to give you kind of an example of some of those things, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. One of the things I discovered in yoga is that my body could give me a visceral experience of peace and relaxation, and that was through my body. It wasn't peace and relaxation that I'd gotten by sitting and meditating, because that was very difficult for me to do. It was a yoga nidra practice. I was lying on my back. I was deep breathing. All of a sudden, I felt this total sense of tranquility, of peace, of relaxation that had been so inaccessible to me before. And all of a sudden, my body wasn't just this thing that I needed to fix or even use to communicate to someone else, something's wrong, which is how I'd been relating to my body up until that point. My body became a partner and an ally and something that could be a source of good feeling, whether that be peace, whether that be joy, whether it be gratitude. I started to relate to my body more as a partner, and that's what I think alternative practices like this can do. That said, I think, where was I going to go with that? The latter half of what you were just saying, can you say it again? Do you remember? I had another thought.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But focusing on the pranamaya kosha instead of the annamaya kosha.
Yes. Okay, I think I know what's coming up. I think that a lot of this language might have been hard for me to hear at that time. Like someone talking to me about a pranamaya kosha, I probably would have been like, oh, you are a hippie and you are full of, fluff, and I don't want to talk to you. that's how my reaction would have been at the time. You're not making any sense to me. Now, had you sat down with me and said, I'd like to share with you a practice that's going to bring your anxiety down a whole lot and your anxiety after meals down a whole lot, because I had a whole lot of anxiety down, and then given me something that I could actually do. So not just talk to me about how I can relate to my body, but gave me an actual practice. For example, my first yoga teacher, I was starting to get sore after yoga practice. And she said, Chelsea, what I want you to do is go home and take a sock and put a ginger root into the sock and then run hot water in the bathtub over that sock until you've got a full hot bath. And then I want you to get in that bath and I want you to soak for 10 minutes. It's a ginger bath and it will relax your muscles. The only reason I followed her direction is because I had pain and I wanted the pain to go away, and this felt like something that would be good. Now, what that ginger bath became for me was something much more, because it gave me 10 minutes every evening that I was totally relaxing, and I would do it after meals, and all of a sudden that very simple practice that she gave to me became a tool I used to relate to my body in a different way, to nurture myself and to be kind to myself and to be gentle with myself. And so it was so simple, and I don't even know if she knew what she was giving me at the time. But I think if Ayurvedic practitioners can offer things like that, another one is like rubbing coconut oil all over my body is For anyone with an eating disorder, I mean, one, that's a scary practice to do, because, I think many people with eating disorders learn to dissociate from their body, not to look at it, not to touch it, not to feel it. They don't want to do anything with it. But that's a practice of building intimacy with yourself and creating, once again, that practice of treating your body as an ally and as a partner and as something to be nurtured rather than fixed.
Okay, great. And that reminds me of the train of thought that had derailed earlier. But one thing I wanted to mention is your yoga nidra practice was a practice of connecting with the pranamaya kosha. And I'm using that language because I know students from my mentorship program are on this, and they'll know what that means. But that's a really good point, of course, to give someone a physical experience of the pranamaya kosha, not just woo-woo, oh, prana is really great, kind of, let me tell you. But no, let's feel it and sit together and do this. And, things like I have a prana CD that has actual visualizations that work with starting to feel the pranamaya kosha and starting to feel what's happening with the energy in the body. And it's a similar idea to yoga nidra. And the other thing that I was going to say, that your coconut oil on your body reminds me of is one of the things that we can see from an Ayurvedic point of view is the inability to receive nourishment, right? Mm-hmm. To receive love and to receive nourishment. And so it's literally hard for people to put food in their mouth and
yes.
receive this love and this nourishment. And one of the word, you know, the Sanskrit word sneha means both oil and it means love. It means both of those things. And, you know, one of the components of food is fat that is nourishing, and the fat is leaving the body. There's no sneha there. The person is very emaciated. And what is that? There's along with other dhatus, along with other tissues, the medha has been severely, medha, the fat tissue, the oil, right, has been severely depleted. Oil, the love, has been severely depleted. The ability to receive love is severely depleted.
Mm.
So, and again, because the focus on food, it's like, no, put more food in. They can't do that. That pathway, that srotas, that channel has been blocked. It's like, thus far and no farther. This is not going to enter me. And
yep.
So if that's the case, if you can't go in the front door, go in the back door, go in the window, leave the front door alone. Don't try to, you know, feed the person coconut oil, put it on their body. It's oil means, is, you know, sneha is oil. It's also love. So when the person does abhyanga, you can read about abhyanga on my website, but it's a warm oil massage.
Mm-hmm.
When they do it, especially with an appropriate massage, that oil, that warm oil, gives them the same physiological experience of love, but it's
yeah.
coming through the back door. It's not going through the mouth. It's going on the skin, but the body will receive it nonetheless. And then it starts to be reminded what it's like to receive love. And so it can be a backdoor to allowing the srotamsi, that the channels that receive love, to be reawakened in a gentle way.
Yeah, I would love to share a little thing here that I think might even surprise you, and certainly would surprise me. But I agree with you completely, and I think it's such a valuable backdoor. But one thing that your students and any Ayurvedic practitioner might find surprising is that I would not do Abhyanga, and I had it recommended to me several times. I wouldn't do it for months because I was terrified that my body was going to absorb the calories in the oil. I was literally that diluted. Like I would not touch oil. I would not put it on my fingers, and it was very difficult for me. And I think that being able to speak to that will you know, if you've got a client who's got a severe eating disorder and has that delusion, I think being able to speak to that might even before they bring it up might be really, really useful. And then to say, you know, I know it might be a fear that some, you know, how your body might absorb this, but that won't happen. It's impossible. And then to speak to why it's impossible, you know, like calories are absorbed through the intestines and this can't get to your intestines through your skin.
That's beautiful. That's
yeah.
That's a perfect point, right? And so you were able to do that. You were able to do coconut and accept that.
I did. It just took me some time, and it took for me a lot of researching online before I was sufficiently certain that I would not absorb the calories through my skin.
All right.
I have to laugh about it now, but it was I was so afraid of it back then.
Right. Right. No, it's really true. It's really true. All right. So so one of the things is focusing on the pranamaya kosha instead of the annamaya kosha, and you know, practitioners will know what that means, but helping the person identify more with an energetic experience than the physical experience can help as a support to what counseling and what treatment they're receiving that is focusing on the food. And and one thing that I think, you know, is not likely to have the same kind of resistance as the oil is, and, you know, people who have studied with me are probably so sick of me saying this, but Nadi Shodhana, the alternate nostril breathing, really gentle alternate nostril breathing, to start to balance the the brahmana and the lungana, the grounding, nourishing parts of the body and the lightening, stimulating, motivating parts of the body, and to really help calm the nervous system. One of the things that Dr. Janaris was telling me is that, you know, really you can look at an eating disorder as an anxiety disorder, and it's smack in vata territory, right?
Absolutely.
So one of the most powerful, powerful treatments I know for anxiety is 10, and I would say in this case 15 minutes minimum every morning of very gentle, very long, sustained nadi shodhana, where the person, ideally, you help them learn how to breathe low into their abdomen so that it expands on the inhale and relaxes on the exhale. And they start with that, they get comfortable with that, and then they go into nadi shodhana. There's no calories involved, and it can really help repattern the pranamaya kosha and take some of that attention, incredibly focused attention, away from the annamaya kosha to help replace that pattern.
Absolutely, and you're speaking, especially with the belly breathing, to something I actually often, when I go and speak at eating disorder centers, it's one of the first things I teach the girls, because they say, oh, well, you know, I'm glad yoga was useful to you, but I'm on exercise restriction. I can't do yoga. And I said, well, sometimes yoga is as simple as just breathing into your belly, and we practice that. And I think, you know, the only kind of insight I'd like to share there is once again, that was, for a while, that was something I was so scared of being still for 15 minutes and breathing into my belly. Like, there was such a disconnection. It was like I was, from the neck down, I did not want to feel my body. I didn't want to know it was there. I just wanted to forget about it. So 15 minutes, you know, to start off with would have been terrifying for me. And one of the things that you know, my teacher, you know, that helped me with the deep belly breathing did that was so useful, she sat with me and she did it with me for a few minutes. And we practiced that for a while. And I remember, this is sort of random, but I remember there was a particular song playing when we did it together. We were in a yoga studio and she had this song. It was actually Sinead O'Connor, Thank You for Hearing Me. And that song, yeah. At the time, like it was like the neural track in my brain for that deep belly breathing was associated with that song. And so when I came home, I would play that song and I would do it. And I would picture myself in that space. That song like would allow me to do it with her. It was like she was still with me when that song would come on. And I could feel her presence and kind of absorb the kindness and the generosity and the nurturance that she had offered me and give that to myself. And so I don't know if that's something that would be useful to other people, but it certainly was to me. And just being able to do it for a few minutes, and once I built that muscle, you know, and I was able to like, okay, I can sit with myself just during the song and do the deep belly breathing, then maybe I could do 10 minutes, and then maybe I could do 15 minutes. And I had internalized kind of the model of my, like I had almost internalized the teacher, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I really love that. And one of the things that this brings up is I had said, you know, we're smack in vata territory. And sorry if people are on this call who are not familiar with vata, pitta, and kapha. I'll kind of keep that to a minimum. But kind of what I mean is, you know, smack in, being underweight is part of vata, being anxiety-ridden is part of vata, having fear is part of vata, not being able to sit still is part of vata. But we also have a lot of pitta components here, which is control and the difficulty surrendering. And in fact, the people that I've worked with have been predominantly pitta, which is, you know, pitta tend to be perfectionist and like control and want to find some way to keep control. And they don't have, so there can be quite a dance between vata and pitta. And one of the best medicines I know for pitta is surrender. And how do we get to a surrender? And one of the things you were just saying, Chelsea, is one of the ways you could surrender into this into gentle breathing was through song. So,
yeah.
And through personal connection with a teacher that you respected. You know, I know Dr. Laud talks about how pitta people, if they as long as they respect their teacher, they'll follow their advice. But the second they lose respect, they're out of there. And so having a rapport with a teacher, and I think if we as practitioners or yoga teacher find that we don't have that rapport with the patient or with the person, that that we have referrals, that we have resources to be able to offer people, so that they can find someone that they resonate with. Was that important for you, Chelsea?
Absolutely, absolutely. And not even, I would say it even go, and one, I would say it takes a little bit of time to build that rapport. It doesn't even take a little bit of time. For me, it took a lot of time because I was terribly distrusting of people. I had a lot of social anxiety, but more than that, I was certain that everyone that came into my life was undependable. And that was, you know, based on some of my early childhood experiences, and a lot of people with eating disorders have had, you know, traumatic childhoods. And so it wasn't even just building trust or building rapport, but building trust with that person. And that person showing up over and over and over again as a consistent figure. That was really big for me. Like, whether that be a therapist, whether that be a doctor, whether that be a yoga teacher, I needed to see that person consistently over a long span of time and learn that this person wasn't just going to, you know, flake on me or abandon me or whatever the fear was. And once that happened, once I kind of reached that threshold of the trust, the trust and rapport being built, I would take, you know, even if what they were saying I was like afraid of or the suggestions they were making I didn't really want to do, I trusted them, and so I would do it because I, you know, like you said, I trusted and I also respected them.
How would you feel, Chelsea? So many people, you know, certainly Ayurvedic practitioners do not have a lot of experience. If someone said to you, Chelsea, I want to help you. I will be here to support you. I don't really know what I'm doing. Here's my thinking. Can we work with this together? And I'll be here with you, and we'll take this journey together. Would that have felt like, forget it, I'm going to go find somebody with experience? Or would that have felt like, okay, let's try it for a while?
To be honest with you, at that time, I probably would have thought you're going to be very easy to manipulate.
Right.
Because I was very manipulative at that time. And so I may have, if especially if treatment was sort of required and I had to choose somebody, I may have picked that person just because my thinking would be like, oh, you're going to be very easy for me to walk all over and I can get my way. And that's just total.
That's beautiful. And that honesty is beautiful. And also I want to point out to the practitioners in the group, look at that word manipulative, right? Manipulation. That's a pitta thing, right? Because pitta's looking to stay in control of the situation. Right. And so there's got to be the right situation to be able to surrender to help.
Yeah, I would also say that I was also very suspicious of anyone who said they wanted to help me. which I'm not saying you shouldn't say, but it was almost like if someone said they wanted to help me, I was immediately suspicious of their motive. I was like, well, what's in it for you? There's got to be something
right.
in it for you.
So,
you know, that's just another, and I'm not saying that, I mean, eventually, like, I mean, I had a therapist who said, I want to help you. I'm going to be here for you. And it probably took 3 months for me to actually start believing that she had my best interest in mind. I was constantly looking for her ulterior motive.
So some of these practitioners are fairly new. They're wonderful and they're heartfelt and they're very educated in many areas. What would you suggest if they have someone come to them as a patient who's severely underweight? There's sort of two parts to this. If you're a yoga teacher and someone comes to your class who's severely underweight, what's your responsibility? And if you're an Ayurvedic practitioner and someone comes to you who is severely underweight, what is your responsibility?
Holy day. Those are two very, very difficult questions. That I'm not sure I have the right answer for. The yoga teacher question is one I've been asking myself and exploring for quite a long time. When I first started teaching yoga, you've heard that we attract what we're most afraid of and we attract things that are similar to us. I oftentimes had severely underweight women come to my class, and I wasn't severely underweight at the time, and I kept thinking, like, why are they coming to my class? Like, why did I, you know, like, because it was like confronting images of my former self all the time. And it was so confrontive. And I remember going to the studio owner, and there was this one woman, and she had to have been 75 pounds. She was very sick. I was teaching in a studio where the rooms were relatively warm. They didn't heat them externally, but it was in Texas and it was during the summer. So sometimes the practice room was 85, 90 degrees. It was sweaty. It was a vinyasa class. So it was, you know, people were sweating and getting their heart rates up. And I was terrified she was going to have a heart attack. And I went to my studio owner and I said, I don't think she should come to class. I think she's a danger to herself and a liability for the studio. And will you ask her not to come to class anymore? And she said, Chelsea, we can't ban someone from coming to our class. Like she could get something immensely valuable out of what you have to offer. And two, that's just, you know, that's not for us to say. That's for her doctors or her, you know, her medical professionals to say. And I remember feeling just so caught about it because on one hand, I knew that yoga had been incredibly valuable to me when I was at a later stage of my recovery than she was. But two, I was really afraid she was going to be a danger to herself. And I don't know where that line is. And I don't know that if yoga teachers, I don't know how I can teach someone how to know where that line is. You know, once someone Right. has reached the level of recovery where yoga is a valuable tool, I don't know that yoga teachers should be the ones to decide that. So it's a question. For me, it's still a question mark. I don't know what the responsibility is. I do know there is a responsibility, and I do know that we need to have a conversation about it. Right. One thing that I've thought a lot about is forming a task force of yoga teachers, health professionals, survivors of eating disorders, and complementary and alternative people who offer complementary and alternative modalities to maybe come up with some ethical guidelines around this. I don't think that I'm the person with the answer, but I do think that if you put people with all of these skill sets and knowledge bases and experiences together, that we might be able to come up with something. But I think that kind of answers your second question too. I think there need to be some guidelines around it, institutional guidelines around it. And I just, I don't know that I have the answer for it, and I don't know how practically it would look, if that makes sense.
I think for me, as a practitioner, if someone comes to me, what I want is somebody else on board who is more knowledgeable than I am in the situation. Mm-hmm. So a counselor, a doctor, somebody else, so that I am not. I would probably sit down with the person and say, I'm not here to change your anorexia. I'm not here to do that. I'm here to find balance with you. I'm here to work with your whole being. And the thing is as we go forward with that, I expect it will be helpful. But again, it's sort of like going through the other door. So there's protecting the person and protecting the patient and protecting the practitioner both by having an expert on board, by having someone directly dealing with that issue themselves, so that responsibility isn't on the patient, isn't on the practitioner who's not very experienced, and the patient is protected, and yet progress can still be made in a certain direction. Does that sound reasonable?
It sounds absolutely reasonable, and I agree with you. The only question I would bring up is just that, what if that practitioner is not open with you about having anorexia? And what if, I mean, there's a confrontation that has to happen prior to, you know, especially for a yoga teacher. If it's just a person that looks ridiculously skinny that comes into class, I mean, one, they may not have anorexia. They could be in treatment for cancer. There's a very, very tender conversation that has to happen. And I think that's where many yoga teachers and many maybe, you know, practitioners that are working with people, especially people who are not out about having eating disorder and are maybe in denial about it, that's where they're like, I don't know what to do because this person Right. has not shared with me that they have an eating disorder. And maybe I've approached them and they're denying it, but I still feel that they're a danger to themselves. So that's a, you know.
Well, one of the things that was interesting when I spoke with Dr. Janaris, she said that she's actually a yoga instructor as well, and she said we need to talk with our yoga classes about nutrition. And when, and she said, you can't, you know, we've been focusing in this conversation more on anorexia, but there are people with bulimia who actually are slightly overweight. So you, they're not going to walk in the room and you're going to be able to pick them out. And people have other kinds of eating disorders, overeating and emotional eating. And these are not, you know, we don't know what is the background. As, I'm not a yoga teacher, but as yoga teachers, we don't know what the background is of this, of every student, of any student. We don't know what's going on. But one of the things we can do if we suspect there's something, and even if we don't, to just include a conversation about nutrition in more of our classes. And I don't mean nutrition like Western style. This is, you know, carbs and proteins and so forth. But, hey, we need to have good food and feed our tissues. And on days that you take a yoga class, you need to eat 3 to 4 hours before you go to yoga, or, you know, or just a general conversation with everybody, not with the person in particular, but with everybody. And that was what that's what she does, and feels that her, that how she addresses her responsibility to, you know, to this conversation. So it's one thing, and I think you're right. I think it's a delicate balance, and I'm not sure even institutionalizing this, or, you know, coming up with institutional guidelines, it would be easy even for a crowd of experts, you know, because it is a delicate situation. But
I
think widening.
Yeah, go ahead. I was just going to say, I don't know if it would be like institutional regulations that I would so much be calling for, but I think, you know, a conversation about this, and maybe even education for yoga teachers, and for, you know, like what we're doing now, educational guidelines around, you know, here's you know, some recommended ways to approach someone around this, and here's what bulimia is, and here's what anorexia is, and here's, you know,
right.
I think there's just such a disparity of information, like real evidence-based information out there about these things and about how they interface with Ayurveda and yoga and whatnot.
Yeah, I think so. Well, a couple of things before we start taking questions, a couple of things I just want to touch on briefly, as well as what we've already touched on, is just Chelsea mentioned about having some early childhood experiences that were difficult, and this was my unanimous, was my 100% experience with working with eating disorders in my clinic, which there was always early childhood experience. And when I spoke with Dr. Janaris, that was one of the things she said as well. It's a pretty common thing. And so how do, you know, when as Ayurvedic practitioners, when we look at early childhood trauma and experiences, we see that, you know, in utero and birth and early childhood, the patterns and the channels in that young being's body are so vulnerable to impression, and those impressions are made deeply. And so then our physiology and our emotions run on those tracks that are ingrained at that in those tender ages, and stay running on those tracks as we mature and grow up and become so ingrained as to almost be unchangeable. We look at these patterns as being extremely stubborn. But, you know, my guru told me many, many years ago, well, 30 years ago, something like that, that a practitioner, a doctor, should never believe there's nothing they can do. They should always believe they can find the goodness, that they can find the cure of the pain of the patient. And so when I would see this kind of thing coming into my office, I realized I you know, unless I'm going to go against my guru's wishes, I have to figure out a way to address these really deep grooves, these really deep impressions, and started looking around in Ayurveda and yoga and tantra. And one of the things that we have, and also in Chinese medicine, is this idea of the microcosm and the macrocosm. And if we take a 24-hour, if we apply this to time cycles and we take a 24-hour period, then we see that dawn relates to birth, midday to midlife, dusk to death, and so forth. And so if we want a little window of opportunity every day to go in and repattern those patterns that were engraved in early childhood, possibly pregnancy, birth, then we go to the early morning time and we apply the treatment at that time. And treatment would be, in this case, Abhyanga, if the patient would do that. It would be alternate nostril breathing, slow and gentle, get to that point. You know, if someone is clearly all of this is going to require time and support and comfort, but if possible, to do these in the early childhood. And if the person is receptive to even consider this idea, say, look, there were, in however way it's appropriate to say, that hey, there was hurt early on. Let's go unhurt it. Let's get up early in the morning and get some oil on and sit still and connect with the divine and heal this. So I'm saying this in very woo-woo ways because with many of you, I have, we've had a conversation about this for a long time. So those aren't the ways you would necessarily talk to the people who come to you, but you'd talk to them in whatever way they can hear and work with that. So that's one way to address that early childhood issue. I don't know if that resonates with you at all, Chelsea, but it's just one way that I found to approach these kind of early childhood issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the only thing I would have to add to that is just that when you start to work with those early childhood issues, it's just a long process. That those memories, you know, as you said, are deeply embedded because they're the first ones that are built. It's long and sometimes arduous and I think requires a level of commitment and dedication both the client and the person that's offering them help. I mean, I think about some of the things that my therapist sat with me, you know, and I had a therapist, I was telling Claudia earlier, I had a therapist who worked with me for almost 7 years and provided treatment for almost nothing. I had zero money when I got out of the hospital. I was on my own. And so, when I think about the work that we did together, she spent so much time, and I think it was hard on her as well as it was on me. And I think that, you know, after talking to her and being out of treatment for a while, I think that's true. And I think even as treatment providers, you know, I worry about burnout the more I go and talk to professionals about this. Understand what you're getting, what you're getting into, and if you're going to do this work, and know that it's deep work, and it often takes a lot out of you. You know, maybe only do it with a couple of clients at once. You know,
One of the things most of us are not going to usually ever be treating more than one or two. So that's very important. Is long haul. And better if we sit down with someone and we think this is too much for me. I really don't know where I'm going and what I'm doing. Better probably to refer out to someone who can go the long haul. I want to share Dr. Kathleen Demaison, who I mentioned at the beginning, wrote a few thoughts that she was willing to share. And so I just want to read what she has to say. And then before we take questions, I do want to address the question of many times what we see is people with a history of anorexia being a little bit drawn to yoga for the wrong reasons. Oh, I can sweat and lose weight. And I'm sure you can talk to that a little bit, Chelsea. So I want to table that. I just want to say that so that I don't forget it. But just going to share just a couple of things from Kathleen, from Dr. Demaison. She says, people who are drawn to anorexic behavior often have an interesting configuration of brain chemistry. high serotonin that allows for high impulse control and very low beta endorphin that creates a very low sense of self. Beta endorphins make you feel good, right? Not eating invokes beta endorphins as the brain attempts to protect the person from the pain of starvation. A key piece for any practitioner wanting to encourage someone to eat more is that the very act of eating will trigger withdrawal from starvation-induced beta endorphin so that the in-between time can be very scary. So listen to what she's saying here. What she's saying is the beta endorphins drop during the scary period of time. That's something we can help address. More about that in a second. So she says, giving up the solace of not eating and over-exercising without the bridge of the new is very, very hard, particularly if one is not aware of the biochemical dynamic operating. Yoga practice that hurts, like high heat and pushing the edge, can actually add to the anorexia because it stimulates the release of beta endorphins and provides a false sense of self. And again, that false sense of self, from my point of view, is over-identification, the ahankar, over-identifying with the annamaya kosha, which is something very easy for most of us because we are in the physical world. But we start to want to bring the person to have an internal awareness of the prana body, of the pranamaya kosha, right? So she says it leads to false sense of self, and I would suggest an over-identification with the physical body. She says yoga practices that soothe, heal, and connect can evoke a slow and soft sort of beta endorphin, which actually fills the core pool of it. Yoga practice that stresses being filled rather than being disciplined and perfect does the same. A loving practice helps to bridge the giving up transition. What a fascinating topic you are opening together. So thank you, Dr. Demesson, for that. And it actually, I forgot that she talked about the yoga, so that leads into that. But I won't, before we talk about that yoga piece and then take questions, I just want to say that, you know, there's all the beautiful things that we know as practitioners, and many of us as yoga practitioners and Ayurvedic practitioners, all the things that we know that are good for reducing anxiety and lowering stress are generally good for increasing beta endorphins, like deep breathing, like massage, like abhyanga, like laughter, all these simple things. So increasing those, they are often going to have food, nutrition, journals, all of that kind of stuff. They're going to be dealing with that with other practitioners, and we can work with repatterning the pranamaya kosha and the manomaya kosha, the mental body, the emotional body. We can work with that. One of the things that's a very common thing that Dr. Janaris said was that there's often hateful mantras that they repeat to themselves. You know, there's things they don't like about themselves, and to replace those with loving and simple words. Chelsea and I were talking before the beginning of this about gratitude. We were talking about gratitude. Just, I mean, these things sound so silly and little, but little affirmation words that if they have, we were talking about trust in a practitioner. I remember with one patient with anxiety and panic attacks, she was so helped by these loving, simple words being written down, and she would ask me to write them down in my, you know, in my script, and I'd write them down, she'd cut them up, and she'd put them on her bathroom wall, and she'd put them places that were meaningful to her and easy to help repattern those kind of things, and it's one way we can help. But Chelsea, if there's anything you want to speak to on that, and also the issues that we need to look out for in terms of going for hot yoga and Ashtanga yoga and these kind of things that could be a bit damaging.
Yeah, two things. For the hot yoga and Ashtanga yoga, I spoke about this in my recent book chapter in the book 21st Century Yoga, Culture, Politics, and Practice that came out. And I've spoken kind of extensively, and I even teach workshops on it now, about yoga as a double-edged sword for people with eating disorders, and it's exactly what you just spoke to. You know, on one hand, it can be a tremendously valuable, you know, practice for teaching people to relate to their body in a healthier way and to relate to food and their emotions in a healthier way. But on the other hand, it can become one more tool, you know, someone with an eating disorder uses to harm themselves, and usually that's through burning calories. But what I would say is that That sort of like lure of here's a calorie burning activity you can do that your treatment team will allow is what got me in the door. I never ever would have gone to yoga if it hadn't been a way to burn calories. And I went, my first yoga class was a power yoga class. And I went to power yoga for a long time. And there was a period of time, and it was right after I lost my mom that, you know, I mean, basically, you know, for lack of better words, you know, crap hit the fan again, and things got painful and hard. And, you know, yoga was another, it was just like starvation. You know, I would go to yoga when I should be eating. Like when I would get hungry, I would go to yoga because I knew the exercise would kill my hunger signals. I did yoga 2 or 3 times a day. I did hot classes. I did, you know, Ashtanga. And it was really, really harmful. And I probably lost 15 pounds from it. But, you know, once again, when I was able to get my feet back on the ground and get a healthier mindset again, that same practice was instrumental in my recovery. And I now do strong classes. I do an Ashtanga-based practice, and it's created a great deal of strength that I think is really, really beneficial to me today. And it's what I love about the practice, is, you know, that this I love the strength, and I'm pitta, so I'm sure that has something to do with it. I don't necessarily enjoy hot classes anymore. I think that was, for me, mainly about burning calories. So I would just say that, you know, I mean, sometimes that's what gets them in the door. And so, you know, I don't want to...
Right.
But the second thing, oh, the mantras. This is a short thing, but I... there was a mantra I used to repeat to myself for years and years and years. It was, the greasy fries, they do not lie. The truth is written on your thighs. And I would tell that to myself over and over and over again. Anytime I got hungry, it was, the greasy fries, they do not lie. The truth is written on your thighs. And I came to yoga, and my teacher was crazy about chanting, and she was crazy about mantra. And she, I believe it was the... I know the chant. I don't remember what it's called, but Om Gom Ganapataye Namaha.
That's what it's called.
Gave me. Yeah. Oh, is that what it's called? Okay. I wasn't sure if there was a special name for it. But she gave me that chant, and she sang with me. It was a New Year's, and we sang that chant for about 30 minutes to ring in the New Year, and that became my mantra after that, and that's what replaced that mantra. So I was nodding my head vigorously. I was like, yes, yes.
So, Chelsea, it seems like, and I think we'll take questions in just a minute, but it seems to me like sound, mantra, and Thank You for Hearing Me by Sinead O'Connor, mantra and sound have been really kind of significant players in your healing, and it's really beautiful to hear. And I guess maybe the last question that I have for you before we take questions from, and what I would say, so that you can think about what your questions are, everybody, is if you've got a question, go ahead and press *6 on the pad of your keyboard, and we'll be happy to take questions in a minute. But, for you, Chelsea, is what's been the most what have been the most healing things for you?
That's a difficult question. I would say that sound and music have been incredibly healing for me. But I actually think I'm slightly synesthetic. And for people who aren't familiar with synesthesia, it's a neural condition that is of huge interest right now in neuroscience. But it's basically where two senses kind of merge together. And so for me, when I listen to music, I actually feel music in my body. And if I close my eyes, I see music too, but it's mostly a feeling of music in my body. It's like, I mean, it's hard to describe, but it's embodied for me, and I was a musician growing up, so that may be part of it, is sort of developmental. So music and sound were always incredibly, incredibly healing. I also took to Tibetan singing bowls, and that was something that I used a lot to calm myself, and feeling the vibration in my hand, feeling it in my whole body was just, I mean, you know, so much. I'm feeling a theme emerge of around, you know, just alleviating anxiety and how useful sound and yoga and music were in bringing down the anxiety associated with my eating disorder. But I think in general, the most healing thing, beyond all of the, you know, the just, you know, practical things that, that were offered to me was the sense of community that I came into when I discovered yoga. And I spoke once again to this a lot in my book chapter, but yoga gave me a safe way to be around people again. I was incredibly, you know, anxious around people when I came out of the hospital, and I was frightened of them, and I was distrusting. And the yoga studio, you know, I was fortunate to come into yoga studios that had a deep sense of community, and all of a sudden people knew my name and were saying hi to me and were inviting me to potlucks. And I, you know, the walls that I had, you know, built around myself slowly started to come down. And so I think that any, you know, I think that, and it's so cliche, but I think love heals all things. And for me, I should preface that statement, love heals all, you know, I mean, not like love isn't going to cure cancer. I don't mean it that way, but, so maybe I don't believe that love heals everything. but it certainly was a very, very healing force for me when I was going to yoga and when I was seeing practitioners who offered me healing modalities was a kind regard and a connection with that person that was really healing for me.
Well, that's really beautiful, and what I just like to bring the attention of the students in the mentorship classes to is both of these things, love and sound. If we look at these, and they're not just like AC/DC is sound, but kind of looking at, you know, Thank You for Hearing Me by Sinead O'Connor is beautiful. She has this angelic voice. Thank you for hearing me. Thank you for hearing me. You know, it's beautiful. It's not AC/DC, right? And Om Gang Ganapataye Namaha, it's a chant. They both open the heart as well as just give the mouth something to do. And when the heart is open, the heart is the root of the channel system of the mind. It's the root of the channel system of prana, and it's the root of the channel system of rasa. So it is a way for the prana, the rasa, which is the juice, the vitality, the juice of the body, the nourishment of the body. It's a way for the prana and the rasa and the mind all to be affected, because if the heart is open and affected, all of those will be affected and nourishment will be given. And that's healing. So, you know, I continue to feel that it's tricky as practitioners, right? We don't know where to go when we have our limitations and we don't know what we're doing. You know, we always can do the best we can, but one of the things I really do feel we can support is shift of the pranamaya kosha and the manomaya kosha, the mind and the prana, through the heart, because the manomaya kosha, the channel system of the body, the mind body, is a blueprint for the prana body, and the prana body is a blueprint for the physical body. So there will be no question that change will happen on all levels when the heart is open. So this is something we can do, and we can support each other. And even having conversations like this, I think, has an effect on the heart, an effect on our awareness of this issue, and helps us have more awareness and more compassion. So if you want to ask a question, press *6. But I have this one question here from one of the mentorship group, and I'm just going to read. She actually has three of them here, and I'll just read them in order here, and we'll address them one by one. She says, I recently met with a client who told me straight out, I am not an eater, but who wanted a consultation because she has extreme constipation and painful gas. She was not asking for help regarding this eating issue, nor would she admit it. In fact, she was looking to lose more weight, though she is already underweight, ran every day, etc. Her cry for help was obvious to me, and I was not exactly sure how to help her other than give her love, attention, oil, and warmth. And I think we've talked about some of that. She says her symptoms were all of extremely high vata, so we had a discussion about what this means, discussed rest and oil, et cetera, as well as diet, et cetera. It's a doorway to a discussion about how involved to or whether or not to address this kind of issue when it's either not openly acknowledged or even admitted by clients. So, Chelsea, how would you answer that?
It's a difficult question, and I think it's a little bit of what we were speaking to, what I was, speaking to before about, oftentimes you'll have people, either if you're a yoga teacher in your yoga classes or people who come into your practice who are in denial. And I think it's the person asking the question seems to have the answer to some extent. I don't know how underweight this person is. I would say, I mean, it sounds like anorexia, and it sounds like anorexia athletica, which is, over-exercising as well. I would say, yes, love and care and empathic listening are really valuable, but if this person is at a dangerous weight, I think there has to be some external steps taken. And a conversation with that person, the difficulty is if this person is an adult and not someone that's under the age of 18, in some ways you're powerless to get them help. If they're getting to a level where they're medically at risk of, having a heart attack or I keep saying heart attack because it's frequently the killer in anorexia, because when you lose weight very, very rapidly, that's one of the places that the weight comes off before other places. So, you lose muscle tone in the heart and you have leaking valves. I'm just trying to clarify myself there. But, I think talking, speaking directly to that person about, I'm very concerned for your life if they're at a life-threatening place. And talking about, higher level of care options. There's a whole lot of eating disorder centers out there, and oftentimes they're very costly for someone who doesn't have insurance, but there's also resources, there's certain nonprofits. I know the ELISA Project in Dallas is one of those nonprofits that work with people to help them get access to treatment when maybe...
Is that outside of Texas as well?
I know there's foundations that exist. I don't know them off the top of my head. There's a website called somethingfishy.org that has lots and lots of resources and lists of spaces. And I don't even know that much about what the ELISA Project offers. I know that they help people get treatment, but I don't know if that's like an open program that you can apply to. So.
And can you spell that, the ELISA Project?
Yeah, the ELISA, ELISA. Project, and that's an organization that was started by a couple of parents who lost their daughter to an eating disorder, and so they have quite a few initiatives. One of them is to do just community education around eating disorders and talking to kids in schools, talking to a guidance counselor, and I know the other one that they have going is to help people get access to treatment. But I know there's foundations out there, and there's oftentimes people run into, well, I have insurance, but my insurance company won't cover it. And there's ways to work with these insurance companies to get time and treatment, and it may not be very much, but sometimes that higher level of care is necessary. And so if the person asking this question is concerned about the life, whether this person is at a life-threatening point, I would start talking to them, and if they have contact with that person's family members, maybe even talk about doing an intervention and having that person sit down with family members and friends in the room and saying, we're concerned about you and we want to support you in getting help.
Well, I think that sounds good, and I love that there's something that people can take away with this too, in terms of somethingfishy.org and the ELISA Project. So that you can do your own research where you are, and it's a good idea wherever you're practicing to have a few phone numbers available to give people, and maybe check them out a little bit yourself before you give the information. when I was talking with Dr. Janaris, I said, what do you think about the hotlines? And she said, I don't think the hotlines are always great. She said, I would rather give them Chelsea's website because just reading Chelsea's blog can help them. And this is a woman, you know, Dr. Janaris ran an outpatient clinic. She ran an outpatient and day treatment eating disorder program for several years in the late 90s. So she has a lot of experience with this, and she wasn't sure what were the good resources out there. So it's great to have even a couple, and keep Chelsea's website as a resource to give people, because I think just people knowing that there's somebody out there who understands what they've been through and has gone through it and got to the other side is extremely, extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. So Chelsea, is there anything else that you think would be really useful to include in this conversation? And after that, I think what I'll do is just open the lines and see if anybody has any comments.
No, I think we're covering a lot of really good ground here. I do, though, I've only got about 10 minutes left, so I...
Right. I think we'll end in about 5 minutes, but I just wanted to open the lines up and give people a chance to comment.
Yeah, and please also, if we miss any questions here, there's a contact form on my website, chelsearoff.com. If you go to contact and you put in your information and text in the box, you can get me directly. And so if there's any questions or anyone that wants to reach out, I'm more than happy to talk with people over email as well.
Great. All right. So so everybody, you're unmuted. Does anybody need to comment or question before we sign out together as a group? Okay, it's a quiet group out there.
Claudia?
Yes.
Hi, this is Durga, Yoga of Recovery.
Where are you from, Durga?
I live in California.
Great.
We speak on the email sometimes, Claudia. I do Yoga of Recovery.
Yes, wonderful.
And I just wanted to comment that it was a great conversation to listen to, especially when Chelsea gives feedback on that, the real stuckness that is the addiction, that is the total resistance, because that's what you're up against when you're working with people, especially as they're coming out of denial. And I really particularly liked what you said, is if the front door is open, go in through one of the windows.
Oh,
believe me, the front door being nutrition with eating disorders is for...
Whoops, sorry.
And all the nutrition things that you could never compete with them on that. So the sort of things that you were talking about, like the Chelsea's attachment to the song and the mantra, that is so key. So in Yoga of Recovery, we teach a really simple class for practitioners to help just through learning the five elements and the five senses and just being able to apply on a kind of superficial level tools to deal with five sense therapies, but mainly to do with sweetness. So bringing in the sweetness through the five senses that is not putting something in the mouth.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you so much, Durga. And there's a little background noise, and so I think I'll put everybody back on. And I really thank you, Durga. It's really wonderful to hear your feedback. And want to thank Chelsea so much for taking time to be with us today. And I know you have a very busy schedule. Chelsea has become in great demand because of her talents and her compassion, and we're so lucky to have her here with us today, and wish you so well, Chelsea, and everybody else. So what I'd like to do, Chelsea, I muted you. There you go. You're
That's
unmuted
okay.
now.
I was just saying thank you so much, and it's been a great conversation, and I'm so grateful to every one of you on the call who are interested in this and interested in learning more about it, because I can't tell you, and probably your clients won't be able to tell you for a long time how grateful for you they are. But you do make a difference, and oftentimes, you know, this is a thankless job, because especially just in the throes of an eating disorder, a person has a hard time recognizing support when it's coming in. So I just want you to know that I'm grateful for the work you do, and probably the clients that you're working with, you know, a few years down the line will look back and be so, so grateful for you. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that.
Well, Om Ganganapatiye Namaha. And we do that at the beginning, but why not? We'll do it. So let's just take just 30 seconds just to absorb a little bit this time together, and then we'll sign off. All right. Well, thank you, Chelsea, and thank you, everybody. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your 12-12-12, and or whatever day it is when you hear this. All right. Ciao.
Bye.
Bye.